When you've been around books as much as our guest this hour, it figures that at some point you'd put out one of your own, and Ashland's James Anderson did just that. He is now a proud author. His novel called The Never Open Desert Diner is out to good reviews. James Anderson is a native of the Pacific Northwest, born in Seattle and raised in the region. He holds a master's in creative writing from Pine Manor College in Boston and worked in book publishing for many years. That's in addition to other gigs in logging, commercial fishing, documentary film production, car sales, and truck driving. He splits his time between Ashland and the Four Corners region, and he's right here in the studio with us. James, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be here.
So you clearly share some experiences with your truck driving protagonist, Ben Jones. How long did you drive trucks, and how much did you like it?
You know, I liked it just fine, but the fact of the matter is it was a very brief time. I was 19, and I drove for a building supply company. And at 19, well, let's just say focus was difficult. Yeah, if you're driving a truck, you better know how to keep your attention on the road. And I saw a particularly attractive young woman to my left as I was driving. And when I looked back at the road, there was a 7-Up truck stopped in front of me. And next thing I knew, there was building supplies and 7-Up all over the road. And they decided I needed to find a better fit.
Ah, yeah. We're moving in a different direction, that sort of thing.
Yeah, moving in a different direction. But I have great respect for truck drivers, and most people look at them as sort of an annoyance.
So how did the process of creating the Never Open Desert Diner start? I mean, did it start with Ben Jones? Did it start with the desert, which itself is something of a character here? I mean, what was the grain that began this all?
The grain that began it all, I think, actually begins with my love of what are sometimes called nature writers or environmental writers, people like Barry Lopez and the incomparable Terry Tempest Williams, you know, John McPhee, all kinds of really wonderful people. I really can't write nonfiction. I'd like to be able to. So I thought maybe what I could do is combine fiction with a love of the natural world. So that's what I decided to do.
And tell us about the love of this particular part of the natural world, because it's not a place everybody could love, particularly, I would think, and maybe because of the difference from the places you grew up. I mean, if you're born in Seattle and raised in the Portland area, you know, lots of trees and leafy environments and lots of dampness, and maybe the desert is just a wonderful antidote to all that.
You know, that's an interesting question. What happens is there's this law of familiarity. What we live in, what we see every day, we stop seeing it. We stop appreciating it. So, of course, I grew up out here in verdant vegetation and rain. And then I lived in Colorado for over 20 years and spent a lot of time in the desert regions and so on. And somehow there's a purity there. What really matters out in the desert rises to the top. The distances and the light, all of those things.
The protagonist Ben Jones is a truck driver. By the time the book begins, he's been doing this for years. So I mean, any book is going to start with a change in somebody's life. So what changes for Ben?
Well, what changes for Ben is he's started this. Ben's 38 years old. He started driving this truck down a 100-mile stretch back and forth way out in the Utah desert. And he thinks he knows this road. He's been driving it every day, 5 days a week. And then he discovers something that he never knew was there, which is an abandoned housing development. And inside that house is a woman who's playing a cello. And that's the beginning for him. And like most of us, we think we know our worlds like the back of our hand, and then things happen and you decide you don't know the back of your hand all that well.
So he never notices the housing development there before, and he just sees it there, and it sees the one model home that's actually been built.
That's correct. Yeah. He actually, not to put too fine a point on it, but he's been drinking too much coffee. He pulls over and, he discovers a a roadway that's partially hidden by sand, and there's a slight rise and so on. So he walks up, and then he looks down, and he thinks he sees just a bunch of intertwining dry creek beds. And then he sees his house, and he realizes those are streets that were laid out, but houses were never built on. So he walks down to take a look, and then he discovers this woman.
Not a very dignified introduction, as it turns out. Perhaps you'd explain what I mean by that.
Oh, well, you know, Ben decides to relieve himself, and he thinks he's alone. He thinks the house is abandoned, and as that's happening, he happens to look up through a window, and there's a woman looking at him, and he sort of falls apart a little bit. It startles him. But as a number of people have said in the last few months, you get to a point in this book where whenever anybody walks into a bathroom, you start thinking, oh, God, something's going to happen, because interesting things happen in bathrooms in this book.
All right. The whole the relieving yourself cycle leads to the bigger and better things in The Never Open Desert Diner. It's the debut novel by James Anderson, but there's a little secret that we've been holding back on you about the number of novels he's actually written, and we'll get to that when we rejoin James Anderson and bring you into the conversation when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today with James Anderson, an Ashland-based author. We can call him an author now because he's got a published novel out to good reviews. It's called The Never Open Desert Diner. It involves a truck driver and the Utah desert and the cast of strange characters he finds out there and the strange ways in which they interact. It's not all strange. We'll get him to explain further as we go along. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to ask James some questions about his process and publishing and his book. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So Ben Jones is the truck driver. He's kind of a mass of contradictions, cranky but sentimental. He has trust issues, but he's trustworthy. He's a lone wolf, but he's a caring part of the community. So did Ben come to you more or less fully formed? Did you let him reach critical mass before you finally put him onto the page, or did he develop through the process of writing?
Well, when you're writing, you start out thinking you know what you're doing, and then you get surprised. I remember Tom Robbins told me years and years ago that when he was writing Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, he said he knew somebody was going to die. And then somebody died, and he just stared at what he had just written and said, damn, I didn't know it was going to be that person. So, there is a sort of critical mass that goes on. But, you know, the situations develop and so on. And then you just have to kind of go with what feels right. And it may not be what you thought it originally was going to be. I don't do outlines. Mm-hmm. My rough draft is my outline. So I just, I sit down and I just have as good a time as I can have, whatever happens. And then when you get it all out there, then you can see patterns and you can see things and you begin to work on it.
So it is a linear process. It's not like you know the ending you're going to get to. I want this to happen 3/4 of the way through, anything like that. It just, you
as
go
a matter of fact, every book I've ever written, I had the ending first.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I had the ending first. And in this book, the last two pages, actually maybe the last page, was originally the beginning of the book. So, you know, you have this kind of idea out there in the distance, and you sort of work towards that, or at least I do. And for me, it's usually an image.
Does it take a little of the fun out of the writing, though, if you know how it ends?
No, not for me, because I don't really know that that's the ending, but that's the way it usually works out. I'm not afraid to change the endings, but somehow I think the stories are all self-contained. They already exist inside you, and then it's just a process of discovering them.
Okay, you mentioned that your rough draft is your outline. It was a very rough draft, I understand, in the case of the Never Open Desert Diner. You did how many revisions after
14.
That? 14.
14 major revisions. I was talking to a novelist friend of mine, Sandra Schofield, and she said, well, you know, you have to write a lot of words to get a novel. And we figured to get about a 100,000-word novel, you end up writing over 1 million words. Wow. Most writers do.
So, I mean, so how different was the rough draft from all the? I mean, when you talk about major revisions, was Ben named Bob and was actually a railroad engineer in Baltimore or something?
No. A lot of it is moving stuff around, cutting stuff out. You know, there's the old Faulkner acts about killing all your darlings. You know, these things that you just love but you don't want to let go. I don't really believe in killing my darlings. I believe in cutting them out from where they appear to be darlings and moving them somewhere else so they're less darling. Call it a compromise.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that every book you've ever written, so this is your first published novel, but I mean, how many do you have sitting in drawers or computer hard drive somewhere?
Well, I finished my first one when I was 16, and I wrote seven. I think seven others. You know, being in publishing, I've always written. In fact, writing a novel when you're in high school, that was probably the reason I didn't graduate so much from high school as I was released into the wild. I was up all night writing and reading, and I was never doing homework. I was doing stuff, but never the stuff assigned.
Did anybody say to you, you're always busy, but you're never doing well in school or something?
Oh, well, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, you know, there was a, you know, on a personal note, when I was, I think it was in the second or third grade, the school told my mother I seemed to have some problems. And so she took me and had me tested and so on. And they basically told her that, in the parlance of the day, I was retarded. And once back then, when that sort of thing gets into the system, I was in special tracks, you know, with, you know, large print, you know, novels and so on. So the expectations for me were not very high, which was great because I got to do exactly what I wanted to do. And the big thing for me was, they said, well, look, try and find a job. Welding would be a good thing. And try and stay out of prison. Those were the two big things. Get a job and stay out of prison.
Wow. That's a pretty low set of benchmarks and an open field beyond.
Yeah. Yeah. It worked out great for me.
James Anderson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an Ashland-based author. His book is The Never Open Desert Diner, out to good reviews. So you mentioned being in publishing. You actually were a publisher for many years.
Yeah.
Ran a publishing house, but were publishing all these other people's works, but yours never saw the light of day.
That's true. You know, I started publishing actually in magazines when I was 18 years old. I published a lot of poetry and short stories. As I became a publisher, what happens is you end up getting jaded because it's kind of a nightmare process. It really is. And for me, the other side of that was because when I was still publishing, but occasionally, more than occasionally, people would submit manuscripts. And their cover letters would begin, gee, I saw your piece or your work or whatever in this magazine or that or whatever, and I just loved it, so I know you're going to love mine, manuscript attached. And so for a while I wrote under pseudonyms. I just make them up like Hermione Featherstone and and so on. But eventually I just kept it all to myself. I went on writing, but just not publishing.
And the Operation You Ran Brighton Bush books, was that it?
Mm-hmm.
It's got a pretty good rep in the world, it sounds like.
It really did. I mean, our books won lots of awards. They were reviewed everywhere in the United States. So, we were very fortunate. And, I started that company when I was 22. Mark Twain once said that the only qualities you needed to be a publisher were ignorance and arrogance. And
I was hoping you'd bring that quote in here.
Yeah, and at 22, I had both in ample supply. I look back on it, 22 years old, and I'm thinking, what was I thinking? But, you know, I found my way through it.
So as the ignorance and the arrogance wear off, you're no longer suitable for the publishing business?
For some of us, ignorance and arrogance never wear off. We just move them to other arenas.
Channel them better or something.
Yes, that's right.
So does the company still exist, Brighton Bush Books?
No. It stopped publishing in, I think, 91, and it was bought up by others. But, you know, some of those books that we published are amazingly still in print 25 years later from other publishers. The Telling Distance, a wonderful book, is still in print. There's just, you know, a lot of them. And in this day and age, to have a book be in print continuously for 25 years, that's a huge thing. Books go in and out of print very quickly.
They really do. I've been surprised at the small sizes of print runs. And which brings us to the topic of the general fate of the publishing industry. I mean, what do you make of what's been going on with e-books and Amazon and all the factors that seem to be conspiring to put hardcover books in the endangered species list? And yet there are still lots of them out there.
You know, I move around a lot. I know a lot of writers and people. Typically, there are two ways of looking at things. You can say, oh my God, the world's coming to an end. Or you can say, it's just changing. There are more venues. There are more media vessels for the written word, like ebook and so on. But the ones that we traditionally associate with publishing, paperbacks and hardcovers and so on, those numbers are remaining relatively stable, maybe dropping a little bit. I think of all the ways we have to access the written word now. And as much as I love books, I mean, I love the way they smell and feel and all of it. There is more to it now. So I think positives and negatives.
You probably heard this joke. It's one of my personal favorites, is that the second book off the Gutenberg press was a book about the demise of the publishing industry.
Well, you know, it's odd because I was part of a group that was consulting years and years and years ago with Microsoft and about this sort of thing. So, yes, we've always heard it. But, you know, back in the early 70s, what had been individual, what they call legacy houses, major publishing houses, were all privately owned. And they began to get bought up by Gulf Western and Time Warner. And the accountants sort of took over. I still believe, and there are still some very good ones out there, that publishing is all about taste. And if you start trying to do spreadsheets and do what they call blockbuster theory, that's not going to work out too well for you in publishing, because you have to take chances, and those chances are based on your taste and the taste of your editors. I had excellent editors that I worked with. One of them, Tom Booth, is still is with OSU Press now. I had great people, and I encouraged everybody, if you fall in love with something, well, damn it, let's do it. Might not sell, but at least you're still in love with it.
James Anderson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, our former publisher, a published author now with his debut novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. He lives in Ashland. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about publishing and writing. 800-838-3760 by phone anywhere in the listening area, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with James Anderson.
Hi, John.
Thank you. Well, first of all, Jeffrey, I'd just like to say that I love your program. I must call every day. I'm probably driving you crazy.
Well, thank you for listening.
I really do. Okay, my question, compare nonfiction to fiction. I generally read nonfiction. I got hooked on it way back in the 70s when I read a book called The Search for Amelia Earhart. I read Unbroken last year. Right now I'm reading a book about Oakland A and Oakland Raider announcer Bill King. It's a really good book, you know, Holy Toledo. So anyway, I want you to kind of compare is there a difference in how they're written or how long it takes? Or like you said, how many words, et cetera. Thanks.
All right. All kinds of questions. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. And the term literary nonfiction, let's throw that in that pile as well.
Well, you know, there's literary nonfiction. I actually prefer creative nonfiction. A lot of what's out there now, John, I classify as creative nonfiction. I made a bunch of fiction writers very angry a few years ago when I said some of the best fiction in the world being written today is called nonfiction, because facts get mixed up. You do things for story. I think more nonfiction now, I think, is more interesting and more compelling than it's ever been before, and that's because you use the conventions of fiction. There's story arc, for instance. There are plot points, you know, you see that over and over and over again. So there's really less difference between fiction and nonfiction than ever before. And I think that, as I was saying, the nonfiction, I read everything. I read physics. I read neurobiology. There's always, in the best of these works, there's always a sense of story. And I think that that's probably what appeals to you. I mean, isn't it, you know, that you're following a story as things develop?
Probably the case. This brings up an interview we had a couple of years ago with a couple. Actually, one was a doctor and one was the professor of creative writing. But an effort to get doctors to think in terms of narratives, so that they would understand the history of their patients as a story,
yes,
and be able to hold on to it better and be able to relate to the patients better on that basis.
I think that's true, and we see that more and more. Of course, that gets abused. You run into people who say, write something, they say, this is a true story. And then you find out, as the case with that gentleman a few years ago on Oprah, he just pulled it all out of his butt.
Three cups of tea?
Yeah. Was that? No. It was another one. But, you know, because people want to read things that say, this is a true story. This actually happened. And publishers and even filmmakers, they want to latch onto that. And what the actual factual part of it may be very small.
Interesting. We've noticed a fair number of times that that people will tell us about their memoirs, and they've changed just a few names. And things along the way. You know, I was just celebrating with a comedy writer a couple of weeks ago. It's like you went to an elementary school named after one of the most ineffective presidents ever, James Buchanan Elementary School. And I said, no, actually, that wasn't the name of it. The lawyer said I should change it so we didn't get sued. Oh, you know, so changing details all the time. Let's the number of writers that you would have been working with in the days when you were a publisher at Brighton Bush Books. I have to believe you learned something that worked out in your own writing eventually from looking at the works of all these other writers. No?
Well, you know, everybody is different, and that's the great thing about the creative process. If you start bringing your own worldview, your own sensibilities to it, which is going to happen to a certain degree. But if you remain open to it and you just let somebody tell your story, I mean, people would say, well, how do you decide on what manuscript to publish? Well, back then, and I would say, well, you know, we read the first page. Can the person write a sentence? And if they can write a sentence, can they write a paragraph? And if they can write a paragraph, can they tell the story? And I knew that something had a good shot at being published, at least in my company, when all the critical apparatus, all the editorial apparatus went away, and all of a sudden I was on page 75, that I was caught up in it. Whether it was poetry or creative nonfiction or novels or whatever it was. So engagement, that's the number one thing. If the reader is involved, they care, there's engagement, you have a chance.
All right. Well, your book apparently has engaged quite a few people. It's called The Never Open Desert Diner. We'll come back and talk more with author James Anderson about that and about the publishing business and some of the responses he's gotten to the book. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with James Anderson and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the writing business, the publishing business generally, and a very specific book as well. The book is The Never Open Desert Diner. It's the work of James Anderson, who calls Ashland home for part of the year. It is receiving good reviews, and it's giving James Anderson a bit of focus on his own career, which actually he may have backwards because he was a publisher first and then became a writer, it turns out. But you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about writing and publishing and this book in particular. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So do you have your career on backwards in the sense that, most people would be a writer first and then a publisher later, right?
You know, publishing isn't one of those things I think anybody plans.
Really?
There are things now. There are places where you can go to learn editorial and whatnot, Stanford Writing Institute and so on. Looking back now, I'm 63, and I've pretty much done everything ass backwards. So I think what's really important at this stage is... this is something that I always wanted to do, and I didn't feel I could do it while I was a publisher. You get into your 50s or 60s. If there's something you really want to do, you better get to it.
So, time's a wasting.
It really is. And for me, it wasn't the writing, because I've always been writing. But it's just the whole publishing process. I mean, this novel, with all its success now and all the incredible reviews... was rejected by every major publishing house and 20 agents. And one smaller publisher in New York City, decided to do it. I've just been knocked out by the response. It's been incredible.
Given the realities of the publishing business now, there's you certainly could have self-published. You had probably enough contacts in the business to know how to make that happen. There's the micro-publishing business. You could have done a limited run. Why work so hard to go through the conventional channel?
Well, I'm a traditionalist in that sense, but I very much believe in the vetting process. It's there's more stuff out there than ever before. There's a saying in Hollywood about you never put your own money in your own pictures. I wanted somebody else to care enough about it to say, you know what, I'm going to put my reputation and my money behind it. Self-publishing, does work for some people, but it's also incredibly difficult because you have to wear every single hat yourself. And I'm not prepared to do that because then you become a publisher again, and I've done that.
Right. That's it. No more of that. All right. So let's get to the writing part again. Ben Jones is the truck driving protagonist of this book, A Life of Solitude, vast barren setting in the Utah desert. A whole bunch of characters, pretty much uniformly strange. Can we stipulate to that?
Well, I think everybody is uniformly strange, but maybe these are a little stranger.
Right. Well, we got the ancient Lacey brothers who live in a converted boxcar with no railroad tracks anywhere nearby. There's Walt, who's the owner of the never-open desert diner. Nadine, her pregnant teenage daughter, Ginny. I mean, all the people in the book are, you could say quirky, but weird seems like a little fairer. I mean, are they based on a community of people you know, or did you like take the strangest characters in your life and put them all in the book?
You know, I see a magical world. I mean, I always have. Sometimes I think I see a different world than everybody else sees. I think everybody is inherently interesting and inherently a little strange. For instance, there's a 100-mile stretch out in the desert, and there's this whack job who, Preacher John, who hauls a life-size cross up and down that desert highway, day in and day out, spring through fall. There's the crazy Lacey brothers, there's Walt, but there's a story. You know, this just isn't random craziness. These are people who have lives, had lives. They've become the way they are. They're living the way they are for a reason. And Ben is the connecting tissue for all of these people, these desert exiles.
He's the guy from the outside world, in a sense, isn't he?
Yes, and he also provides them. He brings water. At one point, he says, he's hauled everything from a wedding cake to a baby mule. He brings barbed wire and chili and all kinds of things to people who live out there. So he's a connecting tissue.
Explain the terminology in the title, the Never Open Desert Diner.
Well, the Never Open Desert Diner, Walt, who's 80 years old and lives all alone and so on, he has this diner. Ben drives by it every day and stops. He drops off motorcycle parts to Walt and so on. The diner is never open, but Walt keeps it in pristine, perfect condition. And there were some road signs at one point. Its formal name is the well-known Desert Diner, but people kept going there because it looked like it was open and it was closed. And so somebody spray painted the signs to say the never open Desert Diner. And so the story behind why it is perfect and why Walt keeps it that way, and yet it's not open, is kind of at the center of this mystery and of Ben's life and all the people he intersects with.
Did you intend it to start as a mystery? I mean, you mentioned that you don't do an outline. Your rough draft is your outline, and the mystery seems to finally develop somewhere after page 100.
Yeah, this is what's been called a literary mystery. It's not really tightly plotted, I'm interested in telling a story, and all good stories are essentially mysteries. Excuse me. Otherwise, why would you read it? And so for me, the most fascinating mystery of all is people, and how we all come to be the people we are and how we interact with one another. And little by little, you find out these people who seem to be just sort of random, free-floating whack jobs are all connected in a way, and there's something in their past.
Speaking of connections to past, Lee Marvin, the late actor, shows up as part of Walt's story, almost an aside. Where did that come from? Were you watching Cat Ballou one night when you were writing this?
You know, actually, that came about. Walt collects motorcycles. He originally buys this diner in 1952, I think it is. And he was in the Marine Corps in Korea with Lee Marvin. One of the things people don't realize in, I think it's The Wild Ones, with in which Lee Marvin and Marlon Brando play motorcycle thugs terrorizing a small town, is at that time Lee Marvin did not know how to ride a motorcycle.
Really?
No. And it was part of creating Walt's past. And not only that is that I think that people often think that the truck drivers and motorcyclists and so on, they all tend to be conservative. Not true at all. And that's why Ben is a truck driver. He talks about the fact that there's just about everybody that you could possibly imagine in terms of diversity driving a truck. And Walt is, like Lee Marvin, tends to be liberal. On the other hand, if you piss him off, he will shoot you. So it's like, yeah, I'm liberal, right? To you, the moment you get in my face, and then as my friend C.J. Bock says in his books, then things are going to get Western real quick.
Indeed, they do. You mentioned the reviews are good. I mean, everyone seems to start with quoting the New York Times review: high, dry, and severely beautiful. I mean, first of all, I mean, I've been around enough actors who are like afraid to read reviews, but then they do, and then they either like get all grumpy or they take it all to heart or whatever. But so, I mean, talk about the process of just even letting yourself look at the reviews.
Oh, you know, the first review that came out was bad. I mean, my publisher and publicist said, well, that's mixed. And I go, well, I don't know what dimension you live in, but... but even in that review, the reviewer found something. And then after that, oh my God, Florida Sentinel, Milwaukee Journal, Huffington Post, you know, and then the New York Times Book Review. That was just like, oh my God. And so it was sort of... for a book that nobody wanted, it was like, gee, I guess I'm glad I kind of stuck to my guns, because there's a chance that I could have published the book if I would have made it, you know, much more plot-driven. But the books that I love the best, and I've read a lot of mysteries, you know, gee, Jim Crumley, and God, I was just so pleased to find myself compared to James Lee Burke. They're character driven, and there's some real depth to them, and that's what I was going for, because that's what interests me is the characters, all the people that you meet in those books. I mean, the first books that I read were by John D. MacDonald, and I actually was talking to Dennis Lehane a few years ago, and John D. MacDonald is a hero to Dennis Lehane, Carl Hiaasen, Stephen King, you know, a whole bunch of people. That's where we said, oh, I want to do that.
I can imagine, as a publisher, this is just a guess, that you probably set up a few of the authors, or at least your company did, with appearances at Powell's in Portland. And then you got to be the center of attention at Powell's earlier this year. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that was actually filmed for PBS, which I guess will be shown later at some point. But, yeah, it was strange because, you know, I was all over the United States, but nobody on the West Coast wanted me. Not Seattle, not Portland, not San Francisco, not Los Angeles. My book was selling out regularly at the flagship Barnes & Noble in L.A. But no, nobody wanted me. And originally, Powell said no. And then later, you know, they changed their mind. But part of it is you're a first-time author. There's no base of support. As a publisher, I understood all that. But also, as a publisher, I also understood when I started my company, which was originally based in Portland, Oregon, no one in the Pacific Northwest would review our books.
Because you were out from the boonies or something?
Well, because we were local.
Mm-hmm.
So I started concentrating all my promotional efforts on the East Coast. And as soon as we started getting reviews in the Boston Globe and Washington Post and New York Times, then all of a sudden the media in the Pacific Northwest went, oh, well, my goodness, where did you come from? But, you know, there is that sort of, well, they're local kind of thing. And I do think that the Pacific Northwest does tend to be provincial in that way.
So what happens now? There are some bigger and better things ahead for both the book and the character. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm really excited. I've just been sold like chattel. I have a new publisher, Random House Crown, in New York, and I'm under contract to write another one, another Ben Jones. I have a couple other books going, and next year, Never Open Desert Diner will be re-released by Random House Crown in a new hardcover edition, as well as paperback and ebook, and there are foreign editions in the works, and so on. So yeah, I'm excited. It's great.
Good times and great success. The book is called The Never Open Desert Diner. James Anderson is the author, and he's been our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. How much of the year do you spend in Ashland versus the Four Corners?
I'm spending a lot of time in Ashland, which is why my voice is really raspy.
Yes, I'm noticing everybody's coughing a little bit today, but that's the smoke story. Life in the region.
I love it here, though.
James Anderson, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.